using public quotes he made to another, to a daily thing with public.
Now we're on the record. We can do this after.
Okay.
Always.
Okay.
This is the July 1st meeting of the Housing Subcommittee. We do have quorum. There's myself and Greg McCullough here. Hopefully Craig is on his way. So first, is there a motion to approve the June 6th meeting minutes?
I made a motion.
I guess so. So I have to second my... I guess I second it, so all in favor. So odd. Okay. So we put on this meeting, and we'll start doing this in the future, I think, put on housing resolutions that are applicable to us. We don't vote on them because we don't have the power to vote on them, but we can discuss them here and understand them better and kind of make sure that we, as members of the Housing Committee, Health, Human Services, and Housing Committee, have an idea of what's going on with them. So, Resolution 371, authorizing the funding for Ulster County's Eviction Services Program. This, as I understand it, and I can probably be corrected, is money to help people when they are in the process of being evicted to hire lawyers and to possibly even pay off some of the back rent. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, is that
so the money that this particular resolution would fund paying for legal services and possibly paying back rent for people that are at risk of losing housing because of eviction.
I want to make sure that this is just to finish up the year, correct? Just the whole thing. It is the whole thing. Okay, cool. Yes, so this is to cover extending the legal services contract, and then yes, it additionally provides, or if this does not include it, there is another reso, I believe, if it's not in this one already, that yes, will also include funds for arrears.
Okay. I think it was in the same resolution.
It should be in the same resolution, yeah. Yes.
Okay.
I know the amounts have been
right.
A little bit moving because of funding sources. Right?
Okay. Okay. And the source, it's not ARPA, is it? Is it ARPA?
I believe that was the original arrears were going to come from ARPA funds. But that's, I think, what is currently fluid at the moment, is where those funds were specifically being pulled from. I do believe they would come from ARPA because they would be being distributed.
Okay.
But I believe, this is all coming from county funds.
County funds, okay. Maybe that they took it out of ARPA because of timing.
So what was going to happen with the, so that's what I'm saying, I'm not sure if this amount to me, if it's the full amount with the arrears and legal services kind of being extended, because the arrears pool I thought was 150, and then the contract extension itself was 500. So I just, I don't want to speak out of turn without having the full set of information in front of me, but my understanding of time was that we have the contract extending.
The original iteration of this contract was for 2023, but it was funded through ARPA.
Yes.
And I think that there was a report provided to the Health, Human Services, and Housing Committee by Aaron Baruch, who is acting attorney for Legal Services in the Hudson Valley. And that might have been in April of this year.
Yeah.
And after that, I think
this is taking a portion to finish out this year.
Okay.
So they're extending it through this year, I believe. I think they have to break it up in terms of the pieces of the puzzle.
Yeah.
But yes, essentially.
And I believe the
county
report,
funds are going to be used to extend the contract.
Right, and I believe the report showed how beneficial it was in keeping people in their housing.
And that it would be more beneficial if there was a pool from which to pull arrears, because it would allow less hoops to be jumped through in order for the cases that they operate to have to go and seek funding. It takes a lot of burden away from the attorneys if they don't have to go and hook up with Catholic Charities in order to find funds here or funds there or go United Way. So, again, having worked in that industry, in that world, is if you just have a pot to go to and you don't have to go shopping for pots, you're fine. Just makes it a lot easier.
Okay.
So that's good for them.
Any questions on this? Dave, you probably know about this more than...
Yeah, I mean, I was in a lot of the same meetings that Laura was in. I think it's incredibly exciting. There are a number of us that have been looking for a program that will help, that will help put resources in action for people that are facing a loss of their housing. Mm-hmm. And we had been thinking about it in a very different way and asking questions like, well, how do we make sure that we're not just putting a Band-Aid on things that actually will make a difference, that actually will have, will keep people in their homes and they won't need the subsidy on if it's unsustainable, right? Like, how is that going to work? And when we heard from the legal services of the Hudson Valley team about their contract wrapping up and the way that they used those other buckets of money, we're like, oh, this is it. This is the mm-hmm. missing piece, because they really can't. It's interesting because they are positioned in a way that they have to have a short-term relationship with the parties.
Okay.
Because if they're distributing, if this was a situation where there was a recipient of that fund that depended on it to pay for that housing, if that funding was no longer available to them, then they lost that housing because of that. Legal services would need to defend them. Mm-hmm. But if legal services is also distributing the money, they can't have that conflict.
Okay,
so they
okay.
can only provide the money for tenants when it is something that they don't have a reliance on. It has
okay.
to be a short-term thing to help them get sorted out. And that was one big piece. And the other big piece, and I walked in late, so I'm really sorry if I'm repeating you, Laura, but the way that that legal services hired a case manager. Did you talk about that?
I did not talk about that.
Okay, the case manager is such an interesting part of the whole thing.
It's Mr. Fuller, right?
Yes, I think that's right.
Your human rights chair. Just
okay.
Yeah.
Gary's great.
So, lawyers, first of all, lawyers are in short supply, right? And lawyers and we have this in our legal department as well. We are understaffed.
Yeah.
When you have a legal team that's engaging with a population that's at risk of losing their housing, there are a lot of things that those folks are dealing with. You know, they're dealing with getting their kids to school, they're dealing with food insecurity, they're dealing with family members that have illnesses, there are a million things. And the lawyers, the team that's engaging with them, kind of get sucked into that
mm-hmm.
many times. And what they did with hiring a housing case manager was having someone to actually work with the client one-on-one to help them sort out some of the other issues that are standing in the way of having a sustainable housing situation. So this case manager is doing things that a lawyer would never do, like
right.
helping them figure out where their SNAP benefits went,
yeah.
right? Like why, like there was one person whose SNAP benefits were being delivered to the wrong place. They were able to get to get in a sustainable situation with their landlord using some of that subsidy money and figuring out how to get their SNAP benefits back. Like that's the type of thing that you need that case management. So coupling the legal services with the case management, coupling the financial bucket to pay for arrears with the legal services so that they can walk in and tell the attorney or tell the other attorneys, the judge, everyone that we can make this sustainable. It, mm-hmm. it made a huge difference. So this is in terms of anti-displacement, this is one of the coolest programs I think we have ever seen, and it's even cooler than the original pilot that we envisioned in 2022 when we wanted to fund the first iteration of this contract. So we've learned a lot from it. Legal Services has learned a lot from it. They've learned that case management part. We've learned this housing arrears money part, and we're putting those together here, and I think it's very exciting.
That's great. Any questions on this?
One.
Yeah.
This program is the one where the woman came and spoke to us, right?
Yes, that's right. So she came and spoke two meetings ago for the Housing, Health, and Human Services Committee.
Yeah.
I just want to add to Legislator Ishutel's point also, which is that legal services is very dependent on federal, state, and external funding always, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they are limited as to where they can operate based on that funding and who they can serve. And so right now, the way that they're currently being funded, because they're out of county funding, they're limited to only being able to work in the city of Kingston at this time.
Okay.
So again, in terms of serving the whole county, the reason it is beneficial for us to be funding this is because we get around this issue of federal funding, only helping, and that's because it has to do with census tracts and that kind of stuff. I can see the question forming, Greg. It's not happening. It has to do with census tracts and who's eligible. And Kingston, much like Poughkeepsie and Newburgh, is one of those historically disadvantaged areas, so they are included automatically. But once you get to people getting evicted in Shandaken or in Shawangum or New Paltz, they're not getting that same level of need. And so we want to make sure that full countywide services. So that's the other really important part I want to stress to the legislature's level, and we'll take your hand there, which is that the whole county be served as a result of the county investing its funds in this.
That's great. Thank you. Anything else on this? Okay, we'll go to 390. This is authorizing the planning department to submit an application for strategic planning and feasibility studies program grant to New York State Empire State Development Corporation via the New York State Consolidated Funding Application, CFA, for development of the Ulster County Modular Construction Strategic Plan for Affordable Housing. Can someone brief me on what that describes this? I mean, I read it, but it doesn't necessarily...
Give me 2 seconds. So essentially, CFA funding will allow us, in order to move, so we'll have a modular construction plan that will be the, you have to do all of this work for that funding, that plan to go into place. And planning is going to apply for the funds, so I have to figure out how that's going to work. Look at that. We'll partner with REPCO.
I think Dennis Doyle.
Yep, Dennis would be a better one. But essentially, the larger expanded version of is planning trying to coordinate modular construction throughout the county, but doing a study in order to determine the best locations for where those would then go.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that is the much less
I've talked. Yeah, I've talked with Dennis.
But feel free to ask Mr. Doyle directly for a better explanation.
I've talked to Dennis a little bit about this, and he does talk about modular construction. I think that's one of the things that we really want to take a look at because it's the least expensive construction.
It also is much more viable in terms of the county, the way their county is. There's a lot of land in places.
Yeah.
And for modular processes or procedures to be used in order to essentially drop units onto land that is determined to be viable, that is connected to places, it just expands the county's ability to kind of respond a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
But this is essentially, we are submitting an application to get funding to allow us to figure out the feasibility of doing this. So we like the idea of a modular plan and using modular building in order to expand housing units across the county, but we need funds to show that this is a good idea, or rather funds to prove that it's a good idea, to look into why it's a good idea.
Okay. This also will impact local communities.
Please tell Dennis I did a better Dennis impression than that.
Okay, I will tell Dennis that you did a better Dennis impression. So, I'll ask Dennis too. It's like, how does this impact the local zoning laws? Because that's kind of an issue that we always have with housing. Local zoning is also part of what has to be taken into account here. Because I'm not sure. Like,
and
I don't think modular is
bit,
not permitted in certain towns.
It's not permitted. In
well,
towns?
Or certain areas, depending on exactly how it's.
I think in certain areas, but I think it also depends on the type of modular.
It does.
Going to reach back into my lumberyard background that I have and say that there's various types of modular housing, and I can imagine the ones that are like snapped together are the ones that don't really like because they're a little bit flimsy, but in terms of certain modular plans, I think could be really
And then also...
And planning can also, I think as part of this grant, would then determine where they'd be the most feasible, and then they'd be able to identify which towns might require any sort of zoning changes or identify the changes where they would have to occur. So just using Woodstock as an example, if Woodstock has a certain area that's zoned where it won't work, but then there's an area that it will work, just kind of identifying the differences between and then seeing where you can bridge things. So,
and like, I think, yeah. And
also
I think,
pretty sure it's open about modular. There's way too many modular, like Woodstock to me is the place where you'd have a greater issue with modular.
And they'll have a confusion between modular and mobile and manufactured and all those different.
And modular is not the same as manufactured mobile homes.
Right.
It is your house getting delivered on the back of a flatbed, yes, but it's not it doesn't have a 25-year lifespan like mobile homes do.
Yeah, I mean, truthfully, when I was in Woodstock talking about housing, they did not like that idea either. So, just to say.
I very much understand. That's why I used Woodstock as an example. Sorry, that's why I used you guys as an example. I grew up in Dutchess County, though, where they will stick a modular anywhere and everywhere.
Yeah. Okay. Any questions from... And then the next one is authorizing the County of Ulster to submit an application and assurances to the New York State Office of Community Renewal for Community Development Block Grant Funds for the year 2024. Do we know what that is? Again, it's a Dennis question probably, right?
It's a Dennis question.
Okay.
Okay, so this has to do with CDBG funds, which are available for housing infrastructure. So this is going to let them rehab housing, and that actually includes, this is really exciting, mobile home parks, and that includes water and sewer systems related too. And it's specific to low and moderate income, which it also covers. So this would be specifically targeting the number of mobile homes parks that we have, I think, in the county. Which would be great, and just to kind of point an example for you all to reference, REPCO, is it Fallsburg? Fallsburg. REPCO did a project, I'm good at this.
In Sullivan County? Fallsburg?
Yes, REPCO did a project, I want to say, in Fallsburg.
That's where my niece lives, so that's why
I'm
worried.
I'm so sorry. Yeah. I have one of those too, I get it. Mine's in my house. So, we're having a day. REPCO did a project in Fallsburg where they renovated an entire mobile home park using these kind of funds, this kind of project. So I'm assuming that this is a similar process in order to identify which sites would be the best for those and which ones are in need. Going to point to mobile home park in Lake Katrine.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good example. That's right by the CSX tracks. Those are all well past due. My father-in-law happens to live in one of them, and it's falling. It's literally breaking in half.
Okay.
Like you can see. Give it like another year, you'll see the sky through the top. Mm. And a lot of mobile homes, that's how they are, because again, they only have a 25 to 50 year life. So this grant appears, without me being Dennis, to reach into the CDBG funds that are eligible for those types of projects.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Okay, do we have numbers on emergency housing? I know it's early in the month, they may not be ready yet. I wasn't sure if they'd be available at this point.
We do have the numbers from the month of June, so I don't know if it's not disseminated.
Not yet. I mean, it's first of the,
So basically for June, our homeless cases essentially remained exactly the same. 286 cases total, which was the same as in May. And that total includes 451 total individuals, which is down 55 total individuals from last month. In May, we have 506 total individuals. So this is where we really need to always look closely at data, because the caseload is not down, but the number of people that comprise the caseload is down. And we had a number of families leave emergency housing at the end of June as a result of relocating with the end of the school year.
Okay.
And that's something that, you know, we traditionally do see. We have 136 single men, 190 single women, one transgender person, and 67 families. So, again, you know, we don't want to overreact positively or negatively. The caseload is about the same. You know, and generally speaking, June, July, August, September, we do see a lot of fluctuations. Sometimes it's people leaving our community, and sometimes it's people coming into our community.
Yeah, I mean, looking at the numbers over historical, there's a range, right? And that range changes every month, and there's, and it's, we're still in that same range.
Yeah,
nothing has really changed systemically. It's just, right?
Very, very true. I mean, going back to last July, just about 12 months ago exactly, we've had 383 unique individuals and 220 cases. really since then we've been anywhere between 450 and 500 with about 240 to 280 cases. So it has somewhat leveled off in the last 12 months. You know, that might be an indication of the fact that at the beginning of 2023, a lot of the programming around the moratoriums for evictions ended up expiring. So last year, between January and June, we saw a lot of people who had been able to remain where they were because of the eviction moratorium, or that they were in leases, stay there. Mm-hmm. And we had that uptick, and we've kind of leveled off at between 450 and 500 in terms of unique individuals. And, you know, we continue to be doing everything that we can to support our clients who are in emergency housing placements. So I guess the positive news is we haven't seen a significant uptick.
You mentioned people changing where they're living because of the end of the school year. Can you say more about that? I want to understand that dynamic more.
Yeah, that is something that doesn't necessarily relate to anything that necessarily has to do with COVID or the housing crisis. It's just annually, traditionally been a time when a lot of people that are utilizing rental housing and in rental agreements, a lot of rental agreements go from July 1st to June 30th. And sometimes we notice with families that come in to our emergency housing unit during the month of June that they're reporting that their lease is ending, they're not able to renew their lease. And then we have families leaving emergency housing who report that they're able to move into a new location. Doesn't necessarily mean that they're leaving the county. You know, maybe they've been able to find something.
Right, so it's another way of saying there is some extra instability because people's leases are up, but that same instability in the market makes homes available, so people are people. So there's shuffling, but there might be, but because you know it sounds like you're describing a trend of people finding housing in June. Is that?
And that can all, we also see that sometimes, you know, another popular lease period is September 1st to August 31st. Mm-hmm. It's usually the calendar year. Most of the other leases are September 1st to August 31st or July 1st to June 30th, because those are the times of the year, because of the school year, mm-hmm. really drives that.
Got it. Okay.
That people are either coming into or leaving housing that they formerly had.
Right.
So if someone has a student in school, they don't want to necessarily leave until the school year ends, basically, right?
Say, yeah, a population, like, they're not going to move. Like, if somebody's placed in Saugerties and, like, that's where their kid is going to school, or if they're getting bused from there to get to Kingston, it is a lot of upheaval for them to move in the middle of the school year. So it's probably more beneficial for them to wait until it's a better time. And, like, childcare changes in the summertime, so, like, you've got some places like the Boys and Girls Club, which is $10 for like a year. So you've got a lot of families that might shift areas because then they can get access to certain things they might not have had access to. But it's a pretty traditional, transitional time for people to be moving because you don't have to worry about pulling your kids out of school in order to do so.
Right. Well, I was also thinking that there could be a impact of the higher ed like alignment of leases. Mm-hmm. Like you've got like New Paltz students that are moving out, and some like it's not like the right. It's not like student housing is only for students. There might be families that could move in there because that lease is made available, or leases that families are in that just happen to have long ago aligned with that academic calendar.
Yeah. It happens more in the complexes than it does in like the regular rental units, like the condos in New Paltz. I think we definitely follow that more than just like the standalone units. I just wanted to add to Commissioner Iacocci's point about the things that the county is doing, and some good news. is that we've had 15 applications for the Helpful Assistance Housing Unit. So we are reviewing applications now, and we'll be setting up interviews in the next like week or two. So there will definitely be, we're excited that we've got some really good applications in, nice. And we'll hopefully be able to then hire and have additional support for those in emergency housing. Because one of those positions is specifically an emergency housing coordinator to go and do those site visits. So I'm looking forward to getting those people on board and trained. And
good. Now, with the weather being nice, and I'm assuming it's going to be even nicer over the next couple of months, maybe through September, how much will that affect the number of cases and the number of homelessness? Because if the weather's nice, people may tend to stay outside and not look for emergency housing because the weather is nice. What impact do you think that'll have? You think marginal?
I would say marginal.
Okay.
Now, traditionally, we haven't seen significant fluctuations among the caseloads for single individuals, including men, women, and transgender persons. And, you know, the nature of that has to do primarily with the fact that people who do not pursue emergency housing through traditional emergency housing programs that might have been utilizing a location like the warming center are not prone to come into our emergency housing system because they're utilizing other kinds of arrangements, which can include a variety of different options that might be living in locations, you know, where friends or family accommodate them during this time of the year. It could be living outdoors. It could be living in abandoned properties. It could also be living in public spaces. So we don't traditionally see significant increases. So that warming center population we've been accommodating that comes in from those kinds of arrangements doesn't generally, during the month of April, when the warming center transitions to closing, come into traditional emergency housing program. You know, and I can speculate about why that might be. And generally, our experiences in talking to those individuals while they're at the warming center, you know, during the end of March, beginning of April, is just a reluctance to participate in the application process. Because to come into traditional emergency housing means that you have to complete an application that requires you to disclose information about yourself, which could include your income and resources. You also have to participate in screenings and disclose information about, you know, what experiences you're having or experiencing challenges with substance use, mental health, other health problems. And then you also have to continue to comply with the eligibility criteria to be doing housing searches. So, you know, our experiences have been that many individuals do not want to participate in that process. So they seek alternative arrangements during the times of the year when the weather is more conducive to creating more options for them. You know, and I think, you know, we have experienced and do see that when we drive around our communities. And, you know, we don't have an ability to dictate to these individuals that they have to participate in making an application for emergency housing. You know, but we don't see, again, significant fluctuations of numbers increasing or numbers going down. The other variable is with our shelters. You know, there's rules associated with being placed in a shelter. And, you know, a lot of individuals, you know, are not comfortable with having to comply with, you know, having to follow, you know, the rules that need to be adhered to be in that kind of a placement.
Yeah, one more question. When RUPCO did the open application for the homeless, some people spoke to me and they said that, this is what I would like to see. Those that are homeless longer, at the whole hotels. I think people that's been displaced longer should have the best opportunities to get housing. It's all important to me. It's important that everybody has housing, but mm-hmm. people that's been in motels for 7 years, I think that's crazy. I don't know if then you never know how if someone is being truthful, but you would know who's been unhoused for 7 years, 6 years, because you guys pay the bills. Maybe on the application you can maybe put somewhere how long have you been displaced. I didn't see the application, so I don't know if that's on there.
So I imagine that you're referring to applications that become available through RUPCO for supportive housing that they manage mm-hmm. and oversee. It could be...
Or do you mean Section 8?
It could be any of their programs.
It might be Section 8.
So, yeah. I don't want to cut you off. Go ahead.
So what happens with that is that there is the COC in Ulster County, which is the Continuum of Care for Housing. It's comprised of service providers and county agencies that participate in administering programs for emergency, permanent, and supportive housing. When there's programming like ESHI vouchers or Section 8, or there's vacancies that might become available in housing programs like Landmark, the Housing Management Information System has what is called coordinated entry, which prioritizes each person that has come into the emergency housing system around criteria that give them a priority that matches them with vacancies or programming that might become available. So there is an effort undertaken to try to ensure that persons who might have been in emergency housing for longer periods of duration get some preference, but I have to be honest with you that there's not necessarily a guarantee. So you could have someone who has been in emergency housing for a shorter period of time that lines up because other criteria okay. make them eligible for either a program or a vacancy. And then another variable to consider, and I may rue the day that I bring this up, is that there is also, with regard to some housing programs that receive funding, the requirement to engage in administering lotteries that go out to the entire, essentially, community, which could mean beyond the borders of Ulster County. So some of the funding that is arrived at being allocated to these programs so that there's not discrimination mm-hmm. in connection with who ultimately ends up being able to reside at these locations, the administrators are required, where circumstances dictate it, to also administer lotteries. So this is going to mean that somebody from another part of the country could essentially participate in submitting their information. And that would be for a certain number of units that are part of whatever housing program has been arrived at being implemented. So I hope that makes sense.
Yeah.
So we can't take the person in emergency housing for the longest time and just put them at the top of the list, because they might not match up with the program or the vacancy that's available.
But it's so taken into consideration.
To add to the commissioner's mm-hmm. points, yeah. The coordinated entry and the COC specifically has been, and we've been in touch about this as well, which is why I can say it, we've been in touch, like the people who were formerly at Chiz's, mm-hmm. they've been displaced, I would argue, the longest in emergency health. One of the people
probably
in placement longer than other folks. And so ensuring that those folks are already involved in getting themselves into coordinated entry has been like a top priority. And specifically, Chiz's is coming back online in the fall. We've been in touch with them regularly for updates, for timelines, and I say the fall, I'm not giving you an exact month because I don't want to give you an exact month. It's the fall. I'm hoping for sooner than later, Greg.
Which year, I know.
I might know, but I just, until it happens, I'm not going to say it out loud. That's how I work.
Just two more questions.
So those folks are already on the list, essentially, to get back into them. I want to use them as an example. Those folks are currently placed at a motel, right? They've been in emergency housing since 2021, right? And so for those folks, getting them to essentially back home is like their priority. And to your point on the Section 8 and REPCO's housing, the county gave up its priority, like its ability, in order to have a county preference when it became no longer the county operating or Section 8 program. My favorite thing to tell people when they came on Section 8 was once you have a voucher, you can take your voucher after you've been here for a year and you can port anywhere, even to Guam. Guam or Puerto Rico, because they are, it's you're allowed to, it's where you can port to, and porting is taking your voucher elsewhere. And I want to clarify the concern that people have about taking your voucher elsewhere, because it doesn't necessarily mean that your voucher is being paid for out of here. Other places absorb vouchers, and so I just, the concept of lotteries gets really icky and gross. And it, yes, is a thing that exists, but they are bound by law. They are bound by law to, and it's different things. So, like, their properties, they don't lottery in the same way on a statewide basis, because those properties aren't a federally funded Section 8 voucher. But the Section 8 vouchers are, like, statewide, and then to other housing authorities notice because they're required to. So just, there's a lot of nuance to when these things get put out there, and just clarifying like how those lotteries work and whether or not there's control over those things is really, I think, important. And this is also where places like when we talk about Golden Hill and the work that Penrose is doing, there was negotiation for a county preference. And within that county preference is also a City of Kingston preference. So even though the concept of a lottery does exist for subsidies, it does not apply to every single housing project that is going to be built, is being built, or receives federal funds. And the idea that anything built as affordable is going to be lotteried and auctioned off, I just want to be dispelled, because that's not how the housing system works. So,
for applications that are lottery off, does the applicant know that I'm filling out this application and this is part of, or will be part of, a lottery? Are they notified?
Section 8 has that on the application.
Okay.
It is required by HUD to have that information on the application. Additionally, when REPCO does, and the only administrator of Section 8 that we have is REPCO, and then housing authorities. And the housing authorities are specific to their locations, which means only their properties. That said, somebody in Kingston Housing Authority is able to get a Section 8 voucher and then port out of Kingston Housing Authority, and then it opens up a Housing Authority voucher. So, like, it's a very back and forth kind of system that works. But when they open up that, when they open up the wait list and they open up the actual applications for those things, they do information sessions. There is a huge fact sheet right on the front of it. Okay. They do group, literally, like we've done, when I was there, but they did group, like, educational things. So this is how this works. And they will always pull off of, they are required by law as well to go through the wait list. So if you applied to be on the HUD wait list 5 years ago and now they're opening the wait list, you will get a call from REPCO saying, hi, are you still looking for housing? Is your address the same? If your phone number is the same? Da 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 da. And that way you don't have to submit a new application. Nice. They'll roll you over. And so there's a lot of effort put in to make sure people have as much information as possible. That's not to say that people don't fall through the cracks. I've worked with this population. Phone numbers change the most frequently. And so, like, for those of you who do work with the population, the thing I always stress to people is, if you are dealing with a person who is looking for housing and they've applied to these things, encourage them to update their information and make sure their up-to-date contact information is on record with anywhere that they've applied.
Last thing. Mm-hmm. I have a concern because it seems like things work one way with the system, and then on the recipient side, if they did the same thing, they would be in trouble or have problems. When families are put in motels in one room, sometimes you have mother, father, brother, sister, all in one room. Now, if that same person had an apartment and they had a two-bedroom, the parent had one room, and a boy and a girl in the room, that would be a CPA's case.
Can I answer that
Why is it?
That's not the case.
What's not the case?
The HUD requirements for apartments varies depending not only on the gender. It's less to do with the gender and to do with the size of the units. You can have a two-bedroom unit for a three-person family, and they don't look at how you configure where somebody sleeps. So you can have a parent sleeping in a living room, and you can have a one-bedroom for a three-person household, better example. So you can have a parent sleeping on a couch, and you can have two children sleeping in a unit. Now, that household might be considered under-housed, but it's not considered a violation or a CPS case necessarily. In order for it, and you can speak to the CPS piece, but in terms of, like, HUD violations aren't the same thing. And also, and again, please feel free to cut me off, when it comes to... I lost my train of thought.
Want me to jump in? So you asked a few different questions, and I'll do my best to try to answer each part of your question. So as far as occupancy requirements go, and again, it's a great opportunity to provide some clarification. Mm-hmm. So social services administers emergency housing. Okay. We have to comply with occupancy requirements when we place families. Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely correct that a standard motel room with two beds that two people can occupy is permissible to be able to place a family that consists of four people.
Okay.
That could be two adults and two children. Mm-hmm. It could be one adult and three children. But if it's a family of five, then we have to be able to go into an additional room. Or, because we do utilize locations that have cabins or cottages, we might place a family in a location like that. We don't, at the Department of Social Services, in terms of when families relocate to or transition back to permanent housing, we don't play any role whatsoever in following them into their permanent housing and making sure that they might be meeting occupancy requirements if they happen to be receiving any permanent housing benefits. You could easily have a family of four in a one-bedroom apartment where two members of the family sleep in the bedroom and two members of the family sleep in the living room. I think, you know, that's not probably an unusual reality. As far as Child Protective Services goes, there is no kind of regulatory requirements about having children in rooms. It's a case-by-case basis, and it would really depend on us receiving a report of alleged child abuse or neglect that included information that suggested that somehow where the children are sleeping in the household is contributing to some kind of underlying abuse or neglect that is alleged to be happening. And obviously, that's on a case-by-case basis. It will be carefully investigated. You know, we try to be strength-based in terms of doing investigations to determine why a family has arrived at setting themselves up where they're living the way they are. But we don't go in with any preconceived, rigid requirements about where they necessarily could be sleeping or not. I mean, many of us may have had experiences where we grew up sharing a bedroom with a sibling or two siblings, and there could be siblings of, you know, different gender in the same room, growing up and living in that room together for many, many years. As long as, you know, we don't receive a report about something that's happened that's being contributed to because of that, Greg, you know, there's nothing. Now, it doesn't mean that somebody might have honestly shared with you that they were the subject of a CPS report, and part of that report alleged something that had to do with the underlying sleeping arrangements. That could have very well happened, you know, but we would have investigated it based on its own facts and circumstances. So I hope that covers the question.
Thank you.
You asked.
And what I was trying to get to was that the shelter requirements in a motel room are not the same as a bedroom requirements for an apartment unit. Thank you for making my brain function. Sure. That's what I was trying to clarify. And HUD is less concerned about the gender of children in a room so much as the number of children in a room.
Okay.
And that the overall unit is appropriately sized for the household. So it's up to the parents and the family how they choose to configure, as long as everything is kosher.
Thank you.
On that topic, though, like, there, there have also been issues, and this probably is not, I don't know if there's anything anyone here has encountered, but there have been issues with local building departments interpreting things, mm-hmm. and it's often the landlord who might have a feeling about the tenant and ask and not be happy about the people that are there, the number of people that are there, maybe the situation changed, and they'll ask the building department to come and decide whether they think it's safe. And they very much do look at the configuration of where everybody is sleeping and sometimes misinterpret things. And sometimes have to go back on it all. And that has happened. And it happens.
It does, and it's a terrible thing. The building departments don't have jurisdiction in that way, which is really disturbing that they would take that power into their hands. And I feel like that's a whole other conversation that should occur at a different place with mm-hmm. a different group of people to make sure that the building inspectors are doing their actual jobs. In terms of relative to safety, we have a harder time getting them to enforce actual building code, so they should be less concerned about people and where they're sleeping. In terms of units that are under subsidy, though, they're inspected by, like, REPCO has housing inspectors that go, and it's up to a HUD standard as opposed to a municipal standard. And so there's also, just to add to your point, you have two different inspections that occur for subsidized housing. You have a building inspector who has jurisdiction. You also have the housing authority and or agency, which has their own inspector, which is required to approve the unit. And so a landlord is also able to call REPCO and say, hi, these people aren't appropriately housed. And so REPCO can send their person out, and they can confirm either this is perfectly fine or you're right, there's too many people in this house. But again, they generally, it's whether it's a brother and sister in the bedroom versus whatever is less the issue. But the building department one is we should talk about, because I have a certain town with many complaints.
I want to mention the lottery. My understanding, and this you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that the initial lottery tends to have, I'm going to say, more people from out of town than eventually end up being there. Because over time, the people that stay on the list tend to be the people that are staying in the community, that are from the community. This is something that I've heard about. Like, there was a contract, you know, when Woodstock Commons was built, right?
Section 8 lists?
Yeah. That was like, oh, well, all these people are not from Woodstock. We want housing for Woodstockers, but these are not necessarily Woodstock people because of the lottery situation. But over time, you end up having people that are local getting into that because they're the people that have moved out eventually. Is that accurate, or is that just a...
I can't speak to how that operated, especially when it comes to Woodstock. Having been at REPCO through a couple of different times, which they opened up the wait list, I can tell you that, yes, there is a plethora of applications that come from the city, that come from all over the place. The majority of people that come on to Section 8 in Ulster County, I would argue, are residents of Ulster County.
Right.
The majority of people who are currently receiving benefits were residents before they got here. The majority of people on Section 8 in Ulster County are people living in the Birches and Chambers and name a senior housing unit, and that's your Section 8 population. In all honesty, that's the majority of them. There's very few, there's less residential private landlords that accept these things than when I was at REPCO, and that was, you know, a good number of years ago now.
I just want to say, so that the concern that we're going to open up housing for people that aren't from Ulster County
the
is
difference,
not
though, when Woodstock Commons was built versus yeah. now, and I'm going to use Golden Hill again as an example. Golden Hill was negotiated to have a preference for county and then right. a separate preference for the city residents. That is a change that I don't believe was available when Woodstock Commons was first built.
Right.
The timing in Woodstock Commons coming online, I believe, is around the same time as REPCO taking over the Section 8 from the county. Or thereabouts, relatively mm-hmm. close. And there's been a lot of changes in terms of addressing the vacancy issues and the dynamics of who's coming in from where versus serving the local communities. And so I would say that going forward, Golden Hill as a model of how these lotteries will be conducted is much more indicative of how these things will go forward. There is a very strong effort to ensure that the county gets served and the city of Kingston gets served specifically as before external folks are going to have a bite of the apple, so to speak.
Yeah, what I'm trying to get to is I think there's certain legislators that are saying that the lotteries are going to bring people from all over the world to us.
Correct. That's not how it works.
And
that
that's
legislator
not how it works.
Is incorrect
yes.
in terms
okay.
of how the lotteries work, and I will simply state it that way.
Okay.
I would add,
I will happily talk to that legislator if that legislator would request a meeting with me, and I will explain to him how these things work.
Okay.
I would add to that, this is one of those issues where it's important to look at it from 180 degrees the other side. One of the things that we've been fortunate is that the Section 8 vouchers do allow people to go elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
We have our contract at DSS with RUPCO, where Richard Gold does outreach to our clients who are in emergency housing placements. And one of the areas of where we've had major success is relocating many families and individuals to surrounding counties with their Section 8 vouchers.
And RUPCO has Catskill too, so it's
exactly.
a really easy way for them to be nearby and not go too far. Sorry.
They don't have the same kind of housing inventory crisis in those other counties that we have. So if we accepted this notion about the fact that they should be limited to only being able to be utilized in this county, we would really be doing ourselves a disservice, because we would be preventing people who could successfully relocate, if they chose to nearby counties, to have a home and to be able to have that option available to them. So I really think that's a very important point to emphasize. You know, having some mobility, you know, regionally in terms of the state or the nation, has always been one of the rights and privileges that we should actually celebrate and not attack as being something negative. I mean, we've had a lot of, again, families and individuals, and we have some data about that from RUPCO.
Mm-hmm.
And if they had only been allowed to use those here in Ulster County, they'd still be in emergency housing.
Okay.
So
great.
This is an important point to raise when that kind of argument is made to discourage supporting, you know, promoting, creating more housing inventory.
Yeah,
more housing inventory is always going to benefit
our
community and the communities around us.
People have been able to maneuver and move around because of that, and it opens up more vouchers here. It's a very good point. Mobility and housing is similar to, it provides a similar value as they say that homeownership does, right? You bind your community, it's strength of self. And so somebody having the ability to move, it's capacity to go if they have to, can be really empowering for some folks. When I did family sales visioning program, knowing that somebody wasn't stuck, for lack of a better phrase, was really helpful to folks that I worked with. And so, yes, I 1,000% agree, and having that flexibility is really important.
Great. I want to kind of go into the next thing, which is kind of trying to figure out what the subcommittee, what we want to do, because, you know, we've had discussions. This is the third meeting we've had. We've had a lot of discussions. We've learned a lot of stuff. But what can we do that's going to make a difference instead of just talking? So, and I'm open to ideas for that and what we can put on the agenda. Go ahead.
I think, you know, one thing I would love to see happen is it could be a way to engage with folks in the community that are working on housing as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of reflect on when we had the working groups for housing, and there were a lot of people from the community that were, you know, in different capacities that were engaging there. I think it was also easier because it was on Zoom, so maybe we can do like a hybrid thing, or you could even do the meeting on Zoom entirely.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I think that's significant is because you end up coming up with ideas. And I think it's one thing that we've definitely achieved here is we've created a space for us to get updates and share, you know, and discuss resolutions that are like on the docket. But I think we're still kind of missing that, like, ideating, you know, that, like, kind of, you know, because there were some good ideas that came out of that, out of those meetings. And I think that, you know, if we're going to, we would have to think about, like, making, how to get people there, how to engage with them, how to make it accessible. But that, I think, would be really cool.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's kind of what I was thinking, too. Some broaden the conversation, bring people in, and have them present to us what they're doing, what can be done.
Yeah.
Would be a great idea.
It's also a good opportunity to have those groups understand what we're already doing.
Yeah.
Because we're doing quite a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Having been to some of the COC meetings, to your point, Professor Jutal, I would say it's very important, I think, to educate the public and the community and the agencies that we work with about the work that the county is doing and the efforts that we are focusing on. I think also if you're going to open up for engaging the community and doing working groups, which are amazing, The problem that I have found, though, in working with those groups in counselor settings is people get into that, let me tell you all about what I do and why I'm doing it.
Right.
And you need to be very focused and hard discussing them, and it can just be like, this is what we're discussing today. Just, I would recommend focused questions and targeted meetings with specific efforts for tasks or outcomes in mind.
Okay.
I'd be happy to help work with any of you guys to develop that as well. I get to say research and operational programs is part of my official title and is my background as well. So I'm happy to help work with forum groups and that kind of thing. But I think that would be a really good idea. And then I know that you've been sending us some ideas for where the county can kind of look at doing other things.
Yeah.
I think maybe kind of getting a handle from the legislature as to what that really looks like and entails, especially in terms of like operating.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's an important conversation to be had within the body, because that's a big thing, especially as we come upon budget. We want to make sure that whatever plans that we were doing and going forward, that we're thinking about the best use of resources and kind of if the county is going to go in some of the direction that we talked about, that we just have a very strategic, agreed upon plan to go forward. Looking forward to the next update. It's got some things that are in the hopper.
Yeah, I know there are some things that we can't talk about.
I just want to say quickly that Friday I was at an event where the old King's Inn was located, and they're creating 70 units, two four-story buildings, one three-story, and they're working with Baxter on that, and even though it's city, I'm happy that they're creating housing, so that's just an update on, and the applicants will be chosen on a point system as what you refer to.
Are they using a subsidy, or are they using... is Baxter, they're just building it, correct? Is the city going to be operating the housing, or is there a partner?
I don't know all that information. I was just happy to hear that there's 70 units and that Baxter was attached to it.
And Baxter was attached. So Baxter, I think, is the builder, right? Yeah, okay. I will definitely find out more. I'm very curious. So there's always a process to how people get put into these units.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pleased to hear that they're working mostly on like need base. It's the same thing that the almshouse did in Landmark Place. It was who got into those units was based on a very extensive long wait list that had long been in place, people who have been waiting the longest, and then obviously targeted populations, seniors, disabled, and veterans. And so those are the big things that I think just, yeah, it's great that that's happening. It makes me very happy. They're also doing a lot of work at Kingston Housing Authority around our gardens, and they're putting in some larger buildings there. So it's nice. I have like three kids that live in my house because I live across from Round Rock Gardens, so I have like three extra children this summer. it's fine. Everything's fine. But yeah, no, it'll be increasing capacity where they can, these places that are already done, so I think is really beneficial. Round Rock Gardens is, for all of the noise that people complain about, is a lovely little area. Thank you very much. And so it's nice to see that they're putting back into it. And the same thing where the King's Inn was. It's not a bad area. It's got some reputational nonsense nearby, but...
I live in the area, so it's...
I mean, I work at the Boys and Girls Club, Greg, we're fine, we're good. Mm-hmm. Cedar Street was my jam. So, you know, it just makes me very happy that they're putting something back there, because a lot of the kids I used to work with spent a lot of time in the King's Inn before it was down, so...
It's been 14 years.
I know. I feel old saying that out loud. Don't say that one again.
Okay, I'm going to... call for the adjournment, I believe, because we have another meeting.
I got
to
make a motion.
Go for it.
I make a motion that we adjourn.
Okay, I'll second it. All in favor.
I have a minute to get some water.
Yeah, we've got 5 minutes.